Matthew's whole thing is that Jesus is the promised Messiah, the one the Old Testament has predicted over and over again, the one who is at the center of God's plan of salvation for the whole world. And this is his kingdom. And Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, these are the ethics, these are the standards, these are the values of kingdom living under King Jesus, the Messiah, the one who fulfilled all of those promises.
Did you know that Jesus fulfilled over 300 prophecies from the Old Testament? Those odds are impossible, but not for Jesus. Today on The Connection, Skip Heitzig gives us a fourfold picture of Christ. But before we get into that, we want to highlight the award-winning Canadian band, The City Harmonic. The band formed in 2009 after serving together for an interdenominational worship and mission event in their hometown, Hamilton, Ontario. The heart and lineup of the band was fused and resulted in a Together for the Good of the City ethos that continues to fuel their modern hymns and worship songs. The City Harmonic rose to popularity when their song Manifesto began climbing the Christian charts. Manifesto is a rallying cry to believers from all walks of life to center themselves on the core tenets of the faith. Their new album, We Are, releasing on September 4th, features authentic expressions of worship that continues to champion church unity. Find more info at thecityharmonic.com. Now, turn to Matthew chapter 7 today as we dive into our study with Pastor Skip.
We have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The four Gospels are really a fourfold portrait of the same person. It's the picture of the Lord Jesus Christ from four different perspectives. Look at the four Gospels as a stringed quartet whose instruments are perfectly, beautifully tuned, and they make harmonious music all together. Each instrument playing off the other instruments, kept in harmony by a common conductor, making it all work. And we behold the beauty of each, but it's the beauty of the whole where the real glory is. Or look at the four Gospels sort of like four cameras on a Hollywood set, all controlled by a director. And so you've got Matthew, he's got his angle. Mark, he's from a different angle. Luke and John, all of them assume a different emphasis. One will pan the crowds and get the reactions. Another camera will focus closely in on what is being said by the main character. Another will focus on rapid segues, transitions that take place. So you have Matthew. Matthew was written to the Jews to show that Jesus fulfilled all of the promises of the Messiah, the coming king that the Old Testament wrote about. And so Matthew's oft-repeated word is the word fulfilled. He tells us, this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of by the prophet. That's Matthew. That's his camera angle. Mark's a bit different. Mark didn't write for the Jews. Mark wrote for the Romans, it would seem. And his view of Christ is that of the perfect servant, the hardworking servant. And his favorite phrase or word is the word immediately. It's amazing how many times you read that word in just the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark. And immediately Jesus did this, and immediately they went there, and immediately this happened. Because he is portraying in rapid sequence what a servant does in fulfilling his master's orders. Luke has a whole different vantage point. He's writing for the Greeks. The Greeks were all about the perfect man, the ideal man. So Luke The doctor portrays Jesus and says, look, here is your perfect man. Here's your ideal man. And his favorite phrase is the Son of Man. Then there's John, totally different than the previous three synoptic gospels, we call them. John writes for the whole world. The whole world, and his word is the word believe, believe, believe. He says that over and over again, about 100 times in his book. So the emphasis of Matthew, the book we're currently studying, is on what Jesus said. That's why Matthew focuses his camera angle on the speeches, the discourses of the Messiah. Mark, his emphasis is on what Jesus did. And like a rapidly moving movie script, we follow him from place to place as he does good and teaches, but heals and works like an ambitious servant. Luke tells us how Jesus felt. The good doctor, Dr. Luke, who gave us that gospel and the book of Acts, gives more of the emotion of the Messiah than any other book. And John, he helps us understand not what Jesus said, not what he did, not what he felt, but who he was. These things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God, he writes in John chapter 20. So four different camera angles, and the one we have been looking at is that of Matthew. And Matthew's whole thing is that Jesus is the promised Messiah, the one the Old Testament has predicted over and over again, the one who is at the center of God's plan of salvation for the whole world. And this is his kingdom. And Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, these are the ethics, these are the standards, these are the values of kingdom living under King Jesus, the Messiah, the one who fulfilled all of those promises. We finish chapter 6. Chapter 7, verse 1 is before us. Jesus continues. You notice if you have a red letter Bible, again, it's all red letter. Jesus is giving one long dialogue, one long monologue. Judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Some people have read those verses, and based upon especially verse 1, have said Christians are to make no evaluations whatsoever. They're not to make an evaluative statement. They're not to be critical of how things are done or what is being said or paying too careful attention to doctrine. Not too critical. And would even disparage those who are in discernment ministries. Because Jesus, after all, said, judge not that you be not judged. Therefore, the Christian is to make no critical evaluation of anyone else. Now, if that is what verse 1 means, we have a big problem. We have a problem, for example, with Elijah the prophet, who spoke forcefully against King Ahab, the king of Israel, and the false prophets of Baal. We have a problem with Paul the Apostle, who spoke against the Judaizers, who infiltrated the church and said that you have to keep the law of Moses to be saved. Boy, did Paul come against them. And we have a huge problem with Jesus. Because Jesus tells us, commands us to make evaluative, critical judgments. For example, in John chapter 7, Jesus said, do not judge according to outward appearance, but judge you a righteous judgment. He commands us to do it. In Galatians chapter 6, if anyone is overtaken with any fault, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. But way before that, that beautiful restorative word that he gives, in Galatians chapter 1, Paul says, even though we or an angel from heaven come and preaches to you a gospel that is different than the one that you have received, let him be accursed, eternally condemned. Boy, is he being judgmental. So here is Jesus saying, judge not that you be not judged, but does he mean make no evaluation, no critical evaluation whatsoever, never use discernment? Because if Jesus meant that, go down to verse 6. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine. Well, you're going to have to make some sort of evaluation to understand who is a dog and who is a swine versus those who are not. Correct? It's the same context. Or skip down a few more verses, down to verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You can't beware of them. You can't be on the lookout for them if you are not prepared to make some sort of critical evaluation. So then what does Jesus mean when he says, don't judge? He simply means, and the word is krino in Greek. Krino means a harsh, self-righteous, censorious judgment, a hypercritical evaluation that pretends to know the motive of a person when in reality you don't have all the facts. Let me give you an example. If I were to see somebody at a restaurant and say, what is that person doing here? What is that family doing at this restaurant? I know what they make. They can't afford this thing. No wonder they're in poverty. They go out to places like this. Now, I don't have all the facts, and I've just made an evaluation based upon not having all the information and judging the motivation. It's a harsh, censorious, and self-righteous evaluation. Now, they could be in that restaurant because somebody graciously gave them a gift certificate. They're cashing it in that night. The Lord is blessing them. If I say, yeah, that person gets up late every morning, man, I tell you, what a bum. Well, maybe that person is up late the night before working on some project, trying to get through school or working hard for the family, maybe a second or third job. So when Jesus says, don't judge, that's the kind of judgment he is talking about, that harsh, self-righteous judgment, not knowing all of the facts. There's three reasons we're not to judge. Number one, you're not the final judge. God is. God knows everything. See, God reserves the right to be God. Don't try to be him yourself. If you don't know something, don't make an evaluation about it. It is amazing to me how many people spout opinions after not researching things, but just hearing the opinions of other people, thinking it must be the right opinion. That's tragic. It happens all the time. I see it even in newspapers and magazines. I see a journalism that is not a journalism of integrity. They just simply take what another journalist has written, and instead of doing all the hard research and asking all of the fundamental questions, they just sort of reprint it. They state it in their own words. It's just sort of a sloppy plagiarism, and it gets them in trouble sometimes. So Jesus then continues in verse 2. And here's the second reason you're not to judge. Because judgment is a boomerang. With what judgment you judge, you will be judged. With what measure you use, it will be measured back to you. You've heard the old saying that if you live in a glass house, you shouldn't be throwing stones. And judgment has a way of boomeranging, creating a gallows that you will hang on one day. You remember the story in Esther chapter 7 of Haman, who built a gallows to hang righteous Mordecai the Jew on, and things turned around against him, and he was hung on the very gallows that he made. Most of you remember that. Fewer of you will remember the next example. There was a king, a Canaanite king named Adonai Bezek. He comes to us in Judges chapter 1. Now, Adonai Bezek was captured by the Israelites, and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. It's an odd passage. You go, why is that in the Bible? You ever find that in a verse? Why'd they write that? What's the deal with the thumbs and the toes? The idea of cutting off one's thumbs is to take away the dexterity, the manipulative dexterity in the hands. You lose it. You lose the ability to fight, to wield a sword. Taking off the big toe, you lose balance. Well, after they do that to him, Adonai Bezek says, there are 70 kings of which I have cut off their big toes and their thumbs who were beggars under my table, and now the Lord has repaid me. It seemed that he made a practice of doing that with other kings that he had conquered, and now it happened to him. He judged by a measure, and he was judged with that measure. All right. Some of the ancient Jewish rabbis used to say that God has two measures whenever he judges. The measure of justice and the measure of mercy. Which measure would you like on you? If God is judging you, which measure do you want God to use? You want mercy, right? Which measure do you usually grab when you judge other people? Mercy or justice? Usually justice. Where's the cop when you need him? That guy just did 90 miles an hour. When you're in a hurry, you don't seem to mind that you got away with it. Verse 3. Here's the third reason why you shouldn't judge, because it's hypocrisy. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? You see a splinter. Excuse me, brother. I see a splinter in your eye. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry to hit you with the pine tree that's hanging out of my eye. That's the idea. Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye. Hypocrite. First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. As I was going over this, something occurred to me. The speck, the splinter, and the plank, the pine tree, is essentially the same substance. One is the other. One is much smaller, the other is much bigger. The reason I can see little splinters in your eyes is because I'm familiar with the substance. I've got a huge piece of it in mine. We are good, typically, at spotting sins in other people because we're familiar with them in our own lives. And we become, unfortunately, very judgmental over the sin that lurks in us. David committed adultery. He took the only wife of Uriah the Hittite, a faithful soldier in David's army, and had an adulterous affair. Her name was Bathsheba. You know the story. David had many wives. He was very wealthy. He could have any one of his wives that he wanted at any time. But he took Uriah the Hittite's wife, committed adultery with her. And so Nathan the prophet paid him a visit one day and said, David, I've got a little problem I need your help on. There were two men living in the same town. One was a rich dude, one was a poor guy. The rich guy had many herds and many flocks. The poor man had nothing, just one single ewe lamb, a female lamb, a little lamb. It's all that he had. It was his pet. He cuddled with it every night on his chest. He fed scraps from the table. It was like a daughter to him, David. This rich guy had a friend coming from out of town, and the rich guy said, well, I got to make him a meal. So instead of going to one of the sheep in the many flocks that he had, he stole the one small little pet from the poor man and killed it, and they ate it for supper. David said, that man shall surely die. Nathan said, really? Because you are that man. You had many wives. God has blessed you with so much, and you stole the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And what you said about that man, that he should die, is what you have done. Now, here's what's interesting. Why did David say kill him? That wasn't the law. The law of Moses didn't say kill him. The law of Moses said if somebody steals somebody's sheep, you got to restore it fourfold, four times, pay him back. Because David was so familiar with the sin of the man in the parable because it was his own sin. Same substance, speck, plank. I see the speck, it's because I have the plank. There was a family that had a elderly grandpa. He was a bit cranky, and he came to visit the family one Sunday afternoon, and he was taking a nap after supper. He was cranky through the whole supper. I don't like this, I don't like that. He was just one of those kind of guys, cranky old man. He's taking a nap in one of the back bedrooms. So one of the grandsons thought, let's play a trick on grandpa. So they took some Limburger cheese. You know what that is, right? You know how stinky that is? And rubbed it on grandpa's mustache. And just waited. The old codger woke up sometime later, and you could hear him in the back bedroom. This room stinks! Opened the door, started walking through the house, smelling, goes, man, this whole house stinks. Walked outside, smelled, he goes, the whole world stinks. It's because he's carrying around the stink right under his nose. Here's David going, that guy stinks. He can smell his own smell. And so often, when we pass judgment, we are critical in the same areas that we ourselves have. So what do? What is the right approach? Not to be censorious, not to be hypocritical, not to be smug and self-righteous, but to be helpful. Here's the right approach. Be helpful to your brother. Look at verse 5. Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye. That's what you do. You first take that out. And then you will be able to see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do you know that when you confess your sin to God and you admit it before the Lord, you're actually helping in the process of restoring other people who have similar situations? That's the first step in helping them. As you confess your own sin before God, that helps to restore rather than to destroy other people around you.
Before we start pointing fingers at other people's sins, we should start with confronting our own. Do you want to join Pastor Skip for an unforgettable tour of Israel in 2016? Visit inspirationcruises.com/CCAB for all the info. Now, here's a resource that will help you discover God's purpose for your life.
What would you do if the unthinkable happens in your life? Levi Lusco tells his story in the new book, Through the Eyes of a Lion.
I won't hesitate to tell you, the experience was and remains the most difficult, painful thing that we've ever gone through in our lives.
Her parents called her Linya Lion. They never imagined that 5 days before Christmas, their 5-year-old daughter would suddenly go to heaven after an asthma attack. How do you walk out of an emergency room without your daughter?
It was scary. It was sad. It was dark. We were afraid, but we weren't alone. Our God-given assignment, I believe, was to take the lessons that we learned and how he brought us through it and to give it as a field guide, as our notes from the fire.
God has not forgotten you.
In Through the Eyes of a Lion, Pastor Levi Lusco shares the eye-opening truth of the power of hope in a world that is often filled with pain, suffering, and loss.
Through the darkness, the light has come.
Through the Eyes of a Lion by Levi Lusco is part of the September resource package from The Connection. Also included, the full CD project Battle Drums, featuring Stephen Christian, Aaron Gillespie, and the worship community at Calvary Albuquerque. Get Levi's new book, the Battle Drums CD, and a special one-hour audio feature about worship with Skip and Nathan Heitzig.
The light has come.
All this for a donation of $30 or more. Call 1-800-922-1888 or go to connectiononline.org/offers.
Is there someone in your life who desperately needs to know that Jesus loves them? Help them experience the far-reaching love of Jesus and the abundant life he offers. For only $6 plus any donation you give above that amount, you can order today's teaching as a special gift for that person. Visit connectiononline.org/radio or call 800-922-1888. That's 800-922-1888.
Tomorrow on The Connection, Skip explores an area that we can always try to improve in our spiritual lives.
Why on earth would God ever have to command you to pray? Just think about that for a minute. Why would God ever have to command you to pray? Well, perhaps because he knows that we don't.
Make a connection. Make a connection at the foot of the cross. Cast your burdens on his word. Make a connection.
The Connection is a presentation of Connection Communications, connecting you to God's never-changing truth in ever-changing times.